Welcome to Christ Church Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com. My home is not on this
earth, not in this world. Good morning. About a month ago, one of my favourite YouTubers, a guy called Destin Sandlin, released a video interview with a four-star army general. Yeah, and this four-star army general is a big top guy. We've got a picture of him here. Yeah. So there's Destin on the left, he's the guy who runs the channel, and then there's the general on the right. And Destin runs this channel called Smarter Every Day. It's really good. Some of you may have seen it before, some of you may have not. And basically he does videos about like science, about stuff like this. He's also a Christian, so he just adds in a little bit of a moral thing to it. And it's top quality. Like, the guy's got 6.5 million views, subscribers. It's really, really good. I encourage you to watch it. But in this interview, it's really interesting. He talks to him about warfare. He talks to this general about warfare. A four-star general is like one of the top generals you can get. So it's a really interesting interview. And the general goes on to talk to him about what's called multi-domain operations, or if you're an American, multi-domain operations. And it's really fascinating. He says that there's six domains of warfare. He says there's land, where you've got like your army, the sea, which is your navy, the air force, which is the third one. And then you have space operations, which is a bit weird, which is like satellites and stuff like this. And then he says the fifth one is information or cyberspace. So you got hacking, you got viruses, you got spying, GCHQ, all this kind of stuff. But then he says there's this sixth domain. And the sixth domain is a bit of a weird one. And he calls it the human domain. And he calls it the human domain because what they're seeing more and more now in warfare is people trying to use propaganda to win the enemy's minds before they win in conflict. So you may have heard about these things with Russia and all this kind of weird stuff that's going on. A really interesting example is the battle for Mosul in Iraq, which is the second biggest city in Iraq. And in 2014, ISIS conquered or took over Mosul, but they only had 1,500 soldiers, and they were up against 30,000 soldiers, the Iraqi forces, in the city. They were outnumbered 15-1. They had pickup trucks and second-hand AK-47s, and they took over the city. Madness. And there's many reasons why, but one of the main reasons that's been reported is because of an intense Twitter campaign that ISIS had. They even made an app where people would download the app, sign up to it, and it would send tweets, authorized tweets from ISIS into Twitter sphere with pictures of the massacres they did, and basically they'd have this massive Twitter campaign and this hashtag called All Eyes on ISIS. In the Arabic world, it was trending. And they'd have this hashtag going out showing the massacres, and it would basically overemphasize the army's power, overemphasize what they can do. And the Iraqi forces, many thousands of them, fled before ISIS even got to the city because they were seeing these tweets. That's mad, isn't it? That's the power of social media, you know. It can literally change what's happening with cities and being taken over. And so the idea is they won a battle in the minds of the enemy in Twitter before they did physically. They took it over in 6 days, you know. That's the second biggest city in Iraq. In 6 days, it's insane, really. But the interesting thing is, we have a similar enemy, you know. We have a very similar enemy. And he works in multiple domains. There's multiple domains of combat that he fights in. He fights for our hearts and our minds. He has his own social media campaign, right? But he also fights for other people's minds and hearts. He fights us to go back to sin. He fights in the spiritual realm, we're told, and we looked at last year quite a lot through Ephesians. And 2 Corinthians tells us about this. 2 Corinthians says, "The God of this world, that's our enemy, Satan, has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." And Ephesians 6, which we read last year quite a lot, said, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, against cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil, even in the heavenly places." Satan is called so many things in the Bible. He's called the father of lies. He's called a murderer. We looked at this last year. Blinding the minds of unbelievers from truth and life. Tempting people to sin like he did to Jesus in the desert. Just all sorts of mad, horrible things. And the point is this. Guys, we're in a war. We're in a warfare. We're in warfare. We're in war. There's battles going on. There's battles for people's minds. There's battle for our minds. And we need to be prepared for it. We need to be prepared. We need to understand how this war works. And we need to understand what power is behind us, what general we have. It's so important. We need to know tactics. We need to know power. We need to know our general. Because in battles, if people lose the general, they lose the battle. If you lose the general, you lose the morale. You don't know who to fight for. You don't know what you're fighting for. You don't know what tactics you got. It's so important we know what the general is doing, how he's doing it. And today we're going to see what our general does. Jesus Christ, the wonderful general. And we're going to see what he does in this warfare that we are in. And we're going to see it in two different ways. It's a really remarkable encounter that we're going to look at in Mark 5. So we're in Mark 5 today. And this is one of the most interesting stories. The other Gospels don't really go through this story as long as Mark does, which is surprising because Mark is one of the shortest Gospels. But anyway, let's read it. So it should come up. Yeah, cool. But I'll read it as well. So they came to the other side of the sea. So they've just come from, what's just happened is the storm in the sea, in the Sea of Galilee? That's just happened. Now they've come over to the other side of the sea. And so they've entered the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man who had an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he'd wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And when they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. And the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to see Jesus, and they saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. It's an amazing story. It's kind of a weird story, right? At this point, as I just said, Jesus' life, he's just calmed the storm. And he's just come over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And now he's in a region called the Decapolis, or the country of the Gerasenes. Gerasa was like a city in the Decapolis. And Decapolis is 10 cities. Deca is 10. Polis is the old word, Greek word for city. And it's a predominantly Gentile region. And that's really important for understanding this text, because that theme runs through all of this text. He's in a Gentile region for one of the first, he's not usually in Gentile region, he's usually in Jewish territory. And the reason why it was a Greek settlement almost is because of Alexander the Great, actually. So Alexander the Great conquered so much of that area and then left, and then cities were founded, and then the Romans had actually come in. And so now the Romans are ruling over this place, and they've got their religious activities going on there, non-Jewish, right? And you kind of get, that makes sense, because the pigs, there's a herd of pigs, right? Jews don't mess with pigs, right? But these guys are farming them. So that makes sense. That's quite important to know. But what's interesting as well is as soon as Jesus gets off the boat, he's met by an unclean spirit. And this unclean spirit, the man who has the unclean spirit, lives amongst the tombs, which is also what the Jews didn't mess with. Like, the Jews don't mess with dead people, right? And so you got this guy with an unclean spirit living in an unclean land, living amongst unclean tombs. And it's the uncleanliness there is just mad. And as soon as Jesus gets off the boat, he's met by this. And the disciples must be thinking, what? This guy's a wreck, right? We've seen you heal people before, Jesus, but this guy is... There's a lot going on with this guy. There's a lot of damage going on. And weirdly enough, right, this unclean spirit makes the man strong. You notice that? It doesn't make him ill. It makes him potentially ill in the head, but not ill in strength. He was strong. He was cutting himself. But he was taking off shackles. Don't you think that's interesting? You see, what's also interesting is, and something that we need to kind of think about here is, there's a clear difference between demon possession and illness. We're going to see in the next couple of weeks that Jesus gets rid of illnesses, and he doesn't assign a demon to that. And here he doesn't assign this as illness, he assigns it as demon possession. And so you'll hear sometimes people say, oh, that person's got a spirit of XYZ, that's their illness. And that's not what we see here in the Gospels. And that's an important thing to know. But what is also interesting is, a question to ask is, how did this guy end up like this? Don't you think it's interesting? Like, how did he get in this position? Like, this is, I've never met anybody in this position. Right? But Jesus meets people like this sometimes. How did they get there? Well, again, we go back to the region. We go back to the Greek influence of what's going on there. In that region, there would have been the Roman imperial cult. Right? The Romans are occupying them. The imperial cults are commonplace. And so Roman emperors are being worshipped. So inherently, there's ungodly spirits that are being worshipped and taking over. And they've got a stronghold there. And so it's completely possible that this guy toyed with demonic forces. And that's one of the things that we've come to know about situations like this. That people tend to mess about with things like this, with spiritual forces that they don't know, and it opens them up to much more serious and horrible things. And notice that it changes him, his character, it changes who he is, it changes him physically, it changes him mentally, it does radically horrible things to him. And a lesson we really need to learn from this is, just because something is spiritual doesn't mean it's good. Because there's many spiritual things out there. Astrology, all sorts of weird things that are going on. And just because it's spiritual does not mean it's good. Some people think, but because they are spiritual, they're going to be saved, that they're cool, they're fine. That's not true. If it's anything except for Jesus, we have to be careful with it. I remember in secondary school, my form tutor, and he was also the RE teacher, he was a Scottish guy called Mr. Dunnett, and he had this thing called the chocolate game, and we used to take the mick out of him because he used to be like, the chocolate game. We're going to play the chocolate game now, lads. And it was fantastic, yeah. But I remember one time, this girl came in with tarot cards. Now, I don't really know that much about tarot cards, but what I do know is that there's some mystical astrology cards, basically, and they try and tell future, and try and tell all sorts of weird things. And as soon as the teacher saw this girl coming with these cards, I've never seen him act like this before. He didn't snatch them, because that's kind of rude, but he took them like so, with such force, and was like serious, and slapped them on the table, and was like, you're not getting those back until later. And you may never get them back, I think, in fact, it was possibly what happened. And I remember being taken back by the severity of his stance on it. But it's because it's a gateway to something that's way more serious. It's a gateway to evil spirits coming in, taking this girl's life over and doing horrible things. It's a serious thing, you know. It's not a joke. I think because many of us haven't seen it for real, we think it's not a big deal. It can be. It can be a real big deal. Some of us, we haven't seen it because we're Christian, and that's a good thing, because we have the Holy Spirit, and where the Holy Spirit is, an evil spirit can't enter, and so that's great and wonderful, and we should be thankful to God, but it's still not a joke. It's not a joke. I'm speaking to my uncle. Some of you have spoken to you about my uncle. My uncle's a church leader in Argentina. And a long time ago, after a big victory in his church in Argentina, he experienced a demonic attack at night. He was in his bed. He was about to go to sleep. A And all of a sudden he felt smothered, he said, and overwhelmed by a sense of great power and darkness and evil. He said he literally, physically felt a weight on him so that he was almost unable to breathe. Right? Now it wasn't possessing him, but it was oppressing him. You see that? And it isn't just him who's had this experience as well. I heard about another American pastor who had a very similar story, and it was so overwhelming that he couldn't even breathe, he couldn't even say anything, he couldn't pray, he could only pray in his head. And eventually this spirit went away. It's not until you see something like that that you go, well, sugar, this is a real battle. This is a serious thing. And Jesus is up against it here. The unclean spirits have said they're a legion, which means, and a legion in Roman times was about 5,000 strong soldiers. Now we know these evil spirits are liars, so we're not going to take it as completely factual that there's 5,000 straight up. But they do inhabit 2,000 pigs. So there is a lot of them, there is something going on. And that level of demonic possession in this man, Jesus has never seen before. Right? There's never an instance where Jesus comes across a guy who's got a legion of demons in him. It's serious. It's an extreme example. And I think that's why Mark, or whoever's told Mark the story, has remembered it. Because it's so poignant. But the good news is, and you all know it, Jesus takes down the demons. Takes them down like Thanos. Man just snaps the finger and they're done. It's mad. Nobody could even hold this guy down with chains, but Jesus holds him down. Not only holds him down, he frees him. Which is ironic. Right? The demons beg Jesus for mercy. These super powerful spirits, they fall at Jesus' feet in terror. What have you to do with me, Jesus? Son of the Most High God, I adjure you by God, do not torment me. They're even trying to use Jesus' father as leverage against him. Which is just ridiculous. You can't use my father against me. What are you on about? You have this mad, unclean, super strong man, and he falls at Jesus' feet. No one in the town could sort him out. At Jesus' feet he falls. That's because Jesus is the stronger man. He's always the stronger man. In Matthew, Jesus says he can call on the Father to send down 12 legions of angels. So one legion of demons ain't nothing to him. The demons have just seen Jesus' power. The disciples have just seen Jesus' power over the sea as well, right? He's literally just got off a boat, just calmed a storm, and now he's come to this situation. He's just got rid of a bunch of demons. The disciples must be like, what? Such power. Mad. No wonder why they don't say anything. Have you noticed? They don't say anything in this entire passage. They're just standing there. They're just watching. They're awestruck. And one commentator said succinctly that Jesus can calm a stormy sea and he can calm a stormy soul. Which I think is a wonderful way of saying it. And so whatever spiritual oppression we're in, whatever severe negative alterations in our character or in bondage or like bondage to sin that we're in, Jesus can redeem us. And this story shows us, even when it's at its extreme, he has that power. He's always the stronger man. He's always the stronger man. He can set you free. Verse 15, they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. What a wonderful little phrase that is, man. Wonderful picture of what Jesus can do to the troubled soul. Calm them, clothe them, fix their state of mind. Our general, guys, is the stronger man. He sets the captives free in this war. But do you guys believe this? Is the real challenge, right? Because we never see these things, but do you believe it? It's so important. Are you alive to the spiritual reality and battle that's going on out there? What spiritual stuff do you guys meddle in that perhaps you shouldn't? That perhaps is you're meddling in stuff you don't know. And maybe a gateway to something much more dark. It's a serious thing. Jesus doesn't mess about with it. People become captives in this. They're held by strong forces that they can't easily get free from. But Jesus sets them free. And that's the first thing we see. That's his power. That's his glory. That's our general, you know. Man gets rid of this foolishness. It's fantastic. The second thing I want us to see in this story is really fascinating. This is one of my most interested part. I'm so interested in this part. And it revolves around the people in the region who reject Jesus. Right? We've just seen that Jesus what he's done to the demon-possessed man. And then in verse 14, it says, the herdsmen, that's the herdsmen of the pigs, fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. That's fascinating. They've just seen Jesus calm this man that nobody else can calm. Nobody else can shackle. At a time, and then at the same time, this herd of pigs have thrown themselves into the sea. Jesus is at the center of it all. And the power of Jesus is clearly on show here. They can clearly see what he can do. And they just can't hack it. They just can't deal with it. Some commentators say that perhaps they wanted Jesus, and I've heard this before, that perhaps they wanted Jesus to leave because it was an economic loss, right? They lose 2,000 pigs, and therefore we want the money, therefore go. And that's possibly true of the herdsmen. But the herdsmen went into the city and told them about it. They came and saw what happened. They were fearful. They didn't own the pigs. It was fear that drove them out. Fear, dread, fear caused them to reject Jesus. Their hearts were overcome with it. It was fear that captivated their heart to literally tell Jesus to go away. That's just mad. When people, one commentator said that when people see the true power of God, it's completely right to be scared, especially if they haven't seen the mercy. And what's interesting is, these guys forget the mercy. They don't say anything about the man. There's no thankfulness. There's no, thank you for getting rid of this madman that's been roaming around and scaring my kids. I mean, can you imagine, guys, if you're in this town and you're a kid? Can you imagine that? You've probably been warned about him. The guy's up in the tombs, he's shrieking, he's cutting himself, he's super strong, no one's been able to hack him. And you're a kid and you hear the shrieks at night, Mom, what is that? That's the madman that we don't go near. Like, and they fix that. Jesus fixes that problem and they don't have anything to say about it. Like, nah. Not a big problem. What? And Fallon and I lived in Longsight, and it's the first thing that comes to mind when you think about a crazy town. I'm joking. But we lived in Longsight, and we would live right next to some shops, and you'd hear all sorts of people screaming in the night because people would come by, and they were just like loud drunk people, though, right? They weren't a big deal. But imagine if they were loud. They were super strong, they were cutting themselves, no one could deal with them, and they were doing it, like, consistently. You'd be scared, right? But they don't say anything to Jesus. They don't say anything at all. No thankfulness, nothing. But then, the man isn't telling Jesus to get lost. You see the contrast? These people, Jesus, go away. This man, Jesus, I want to follow you. The man isn't telling Jesus to get lost, and he's seen all the power that they've seen. Why is that? That's because he's seen the power, but he's also felt the mercy. Right? He's seen the heart of Jesus, and it's compelled him, it's given him the confidence to go to the feet of Jesus, literally. That's the difference, it's the mercy. The people beg him to leave, they beg him to leave. Spurgeon said something really interesting. He said, I think there were more lunatics than one on that Gadarene shore. The people were all as mad at heart as that poor man was mad in brain. Which is interesting. These guys were mad to beg Jesus to leave. And so what does Jesus do? He accepts their request. What? Jesus, you're the best thing for these people. And he goes, I'm going to leave. All right. What? He gets back on the boat. But it's a fascinating insight into how Jesus deals with people, right? He could have judged them right there and then, as he's done previously, right? He did it with Capernaum. He did it with Tyre and Sidon, and saying, Sodom and Gomorrah will come up, will be raised in the judgment, and they will judge you for what you've rejected. You've rejected what the sign better than Jonah, the sign better than Solomon. And to these guys who completely reject him, they beg him to leave, he doesn't say any of that. My only idea is that it's because they're Gentiles. They're not Jews. They haven't got a clue what Jesus is about. He steps up, and because of that, he steps away and he goes, I'm now a stumbling block. And I need to have a soft touch to you guys because you are rejecting me. They weren't going to listen to him anymore. Right? They had such fear, they're begging him to leave. We're not going to listen to you anymore. So Jesus goes, well, okay. What are we going to do? Well, it wouldn't be the end for them, as we read. Amazingly, despite him getting rejected, Jesus sends the man back in. He didn't have to, and he doesn't usually do it. Usually he heals somebody and then says, don't tell anybody. But here he does. Again, it's a Gentile region. All the other regions are Jewish. And Jesus doesn't want that uprising in the Jewish land. But over in the Gentile land, it doesn't matter about that. Spread the gospel. Because people aren't gonna raise him up as the Messiah and make him king in those places, right? Verse 18, and as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him, and he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. See, Jesus still shows his mercy towards these guys despite their rejection. He battles for their hearts and their minds, but he does it in a different way than perhaps what I expected anyway, right? It's not through himself, it's through this man's testimony. That's Jesus' tactic here. With the demons, he had a strong reaction. Snaps the fingers, says a word, they're gone. But with these guys, it's soft, it's subtle. Two different wars, two different domains of battle, and he deals with them in two different ways. And the captives, these guys are captives. 2 Corinthians says, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. You see, the God of this world has blinded these people here. He's captivated their hearts, he's captivated their minds, but not with good things, with fear of Jesus. It's interesting because if you remember, the demons were begging Jesus that they could stay in the country. Do you remember that? What did they say? They said, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Why is that? They must have had a stronghold there. They had a stronghold over these people. And how does Jesus battle that? He sends the man back in. He sends the man back in. That's mad. That's how he's going to subvert the evil foundation that these demons have got on that land. By sending the man in. It's ironic that the demon-possessed man, who was possessed by demons, who was possessed by a horrible unclean spirits, would be the man that would be their, not their salvation, but their route towards salvation. Right? Verse 19 says, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Tom Wright, who's a theologian, said that this man was the first apostle to the Gentiles. And we don't even know his name. That's mad. The story is crazy, man. And this guy doesn't get any formal training by Jesus. No Bible college. No retreat. No going on the boat. He's immediately sent out. And we don't even know his name. This is the real challenge for us who haven't been to Bible college, who haven't been on a retreat for a few months to figure out our theology and then go back out. Right? We have fantastic leadership here at CCM, you know. I genuinely believe it. The grace that's been to me has been amazing. But And you know, I actually think sometimes, man, it'd be great if Tim was at my workplace or Tom was at my workplace or Colin was at my workplace, because they have such light in them. They'd be able to tell the gospel. They'd be able to do all this. And they're kind of like the spiritual guys, right? They don't like to see them. No, Tim's not in his head. And yeah. But because they're the leaders, we kind of see them like that, right? And the reality is, Tim is not at my workplace. I am. Tim isn't at your workplace. You are. The temptation for us is to think, I need to go away, get in the boat, go to Bible college, and go learn about Jesus and then come back. And you know what? For some of us, that's true, right? The disciples, that was them. That was them. But for others, it's not. You may not be in leadership. That's okay. Right? That's fine. There's no problem with that. You're just as important and you're just as effective in this battle. Jesus sends this guy out. He's a leader in a different way. He's not like a disciple. He's not an apostle, but he's an apostle. Do you see what I'm saying? He's so important to the Gentiles here. He's their only hope, in a sense. And Jesus sends this guy out, barely untrained, to fight for the scared people's hearts and minds, to free them from captivity, simply by telling what Jesus has done for him. And That's amazing. That's the second thing we see in this passage. And you know, bringing it together in this passage, we see the war being played out, right? There's a battle spiritually, and then there's a battle for hearts and minds. And here Jesus combats the two in different ways. The one he can deal with words, like fast, snap, boom, it's out. But the other one he has to deal with more soft. It's much less straightforward. There's so much you can get out of it. There's so many interesting things that happen, but the thing that I think is really on show here is that Jesus has tactics for different things. He deals with people differently. An army of oppressive demons he'll smash, but he won't smash a hard rock of a heart, right? He'd rather be gentle, that it would soften and then come back to him. It's fascinating. We have such an insight into Jesus here. You see him as kind of the lion smashing his enemies. And then you see him as the lamb being gentle towards those that he needs, that he wants to bring closer to him. Does that make sense? There's a war here. Different battles. Different responses. The four-star army general that I started off by talking about, he had 30 badges of honor from all the different battles he'd been in. So many medals. And if you listen to him, the guy just exudes leadership. I encourage you to watch. It's really interesting. You just listen to him. You just have confidence in what he's saying. It's weird. But we have a general, guys, who has much better battle scars, much better badges of honor. He exudes much better leadership than this guy, even a four-star general. And you know, all of Jesus' life, he was fighting these two battles. He was fighting for them. He was fighting against principalities, against powers, against spiritual forces, for people's minds, for people's hearts, for our hearts and minds, right? And his greatest act in his entire life, we're told, would be the decisive blow against the enemy. Colossians 2 tells us, "And you who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by cancelling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him." That's in the cross. And so in Jesus dying for us, the record of debt is now nailed to the cross. And the evil ones have no reason to accuse us. They have no accusation against us. Nor can he keep us bound in captivity and in sin. We're released, we're free, and in this warfare, we're brought out from captives to free people. Ephesians 2 tells us similar things. "You were dead in trespasses and in sin, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you've been saved." Jesus has set us free from the power of darkness. By the cross, making us alive, making us sinless, blameless. And now us Gentiles, which is us in the story, we are the people who are rejecting Jesus sometimes, or who used to be, right? We are the Gentiles, we are the non-Jews, and we're brought in because of people like this apostle, this first apostle. Jesus brings us in decisively through dying on the cross. And resurrecting to new life, giving us new life. And this whole passage is fascinating because it's a picture of our own story as well. Right? Jesus sets us free from darkness and he gives us a mission. To go back to our Gentile friends and tell them the good news of what he's done for us. But guys, do we join in the battle? Or do we watch from the sidelines? Because it's a battle and that means you have to get involved. You can't sit and watch on the sidelines. In fact, you are involved, whether you like it or not. And some of us try to sit on the sidelines and not do anything. Jesus calls us to enter this battle with him. Against oppressive spiritual forces, for people to be liberated, for their minds and their hearts to be liberated and free. Do you believe that Jesus does that? That's a challenge. How does Jesus liberate people's hearts and minds? He does it through the cross. But how? How does that What is that mechanism? How does that work itself out? It's so vital that we know this. It's so vital, because otherwise we're not going to have any reason to follow the general. We're not going to know what we're fighting. We're not going to know what we're doing. You know, for me, I was a captive to darkness when I was a kid, when before I was a Christian. And I was just following the course of the world. I was an utterly privileged English teenager. Many of us were, right? And I used to love all sorts of things that were stupid. All sorts of things that failed in many ways. Money, football for me was a big one. Clothing was a little bit more of one. Girls was an obvious one. My mind was captured in the world's flow, right? But then I was set free, and I was set free to think differently, to feel with compassion and joy that I'd never felt before, and most importantly, to be alive to God. That's just amazing, to go from being dead to God to being alive to Him, to knowing Him. That's the amazing thing. That's what Jesus does here. That's what we learn from this thing. And it all came and continues to come from Jesus and His cross. If Jesus hadn't died, hadn't resurrected, none of that would have happened. We're in a battle, guys. We've got to fight. We've got to know our general.